Aloha! You are listening to Inside the Desert Oasis Room, episode number 40. This episode is sponsored by Tanduay Rum. Established in the Philippines in 1854, Tanduay is the world's largest rum producer and winner of over 170 international medals in the past four decades, including Brand of the Year in London's World Branding Awards Rum category from 2015 to 2017 and Rum Brand Champion of the World by TheSpiritsBusiness.com in 2015. As sponsor of the Inside the Desert Oasis Room podcast and the toast to Master Ninja Ray Buen at the legendary Tiki Tea in Los Angeles, California, Tanduay Rum is the perfect companion to celebrate all things tiki. For more information, check out their webpage at TanduayUS.com or follow them on Facebook or Instagram at TanduayUSA. This podcast is also sponsored in part by the Royal Hawaiian. Founded in Laguna Beach, California in 1947, the Royal Hawaiian is South Orange County's premier tropical drink and dining destination. Come try their signature cocktail, the Lapu Lapu, a delicious combination of tropical fruit juices with a generous float of dark spirits, or other island-inspired favorites like ahi tuna poke or the dynamite crab-crusted mahi-mahi. Enjoy their delicious brunch or drop in for happy hour from 2:30 to 5:30 p.m. daily for drink specials and more. To make a reservation, visit RoyalHawaiianLB.com. So a few months ago, we released a podcast with Mike Sr. and Jr. of the legendary Tiki Tea in Hollywood, California. It was founded by their patriarch, Ray Buen, one of the original bartenders at Don the Beachcomber, the bar that started tropical craft cocktail mixology and kicked off a decades-long era of Polynesian pop. I got so much positive feedback from the episode and many requests to do a sequel. Listeners simply wanted more stories about Ray and the old days of Tiki. So having said that, we sat down for a sequel, and in this episode, we bring that sequel to you. Mike Sr. shares more stories of Ray, the other bars he bartended at, and the celebrities he catered to. As you all know, this podcast does not exist without the help of our sponsors or our listeners. So if you'd like to help, please visit polynesianpop.podomatic.com and click on the donate button. Every donation, no matter how small, keeps the podcast coming to you every week. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did bringing it to you. Here's my conversation with Mike Sr. of the legendary Tiki Tea.
Inside the Desert Oasis Room.
Yeah, Nick, man, you know, he started this magazine. He did a really good job on it.
Yeah. How old is that article?
This was 2005. Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's one of the early ones then. So volume one, number two, that's the second issue.
Second issue, yeah. Miles Thompson did, well, that's...
Right.
That.
So Miles did the cover, but that's
the one that's in the, yeah, that's the one that's... in the other side there.
Right.
Yeah, he did that. And there's an article on Miles in here and us. And
yeah, and there's Ron.
Yeah.
And that's in his old Rincon room.
Yeah.
He's since moved.
He's Miles.
Then. And, you know, back then, magazines were still somewhat a popular thing in the stores because digital hadn't really taken off yet.
Really? Yeah.
And now... everybody gets their stories online. So like when this magazine would come out, you know, it would write about events and then you wouldn't hear about the write-up until 3 months later because of the publishing time of the magazine.
Hmm.
But with the internet, you know, people are posting pictures from the event and writing about things from the event. Hey, there's Judd.
Judd, yeah, the Maikai Gents.
Yeah.
His wife.
So, you know, when he left for Napa, you guys gave him a card and... it's the first card that I got my name on in here. Judd's card.
Judd?
Yeah.
Yeah, James DeMeyer.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was telling me, you know, he lives in Vegas.
Oh, he's that magician.
Yeah. And he says he's got his house is all tiki now.
Right.
He said he's got a pool with all these giant tikis. And
have you talked to him recently?
When he comes in, yeah.
He still comes in here?
Yeah, yeah. Well, when he does some work over at the
The Magic Castle.
Magic Castle, yeah.
Yeah.
He comes
in.
Yeah. In fact, I gave him, he was using one of the glasses for the Tiki Kapu, because he couldn't get that type of a glass. So I gave him one, and he used that in his act.
Okay.
But then he found a bunch of them somewhere in a secondhand store, so he came back in and gave me like six more. Says, hey, Mike, here, I found a bunch of them, so here, I bought like a dozen of them. So here, take these.
Is that glass still being made somewhere?
I doubt it. That was an old glass that was made. We got that at Rykoff.
Right.
That was downtown. They made all those glasses and tiki stuff.
Is that... I know that you break a lot of the chimney glasses just because they're tall.
Yeah, that and... a lot of them. Well, we break them, people break them, and... Hell, Greg broke one the other night, and Mikey, last week, Greg broke one and cut his hand, and Mikey broke one and cut his hand.
Wow.
2 days apart. It's like, wow, what's going on here?
Come on, you guys. You know that Tiki Kapu? My guess is that bottom neck part is part of the measurement. So if you didn't have that glass, when you pour that syrup into the bottom, that you would have to measure that another way, right?
Yeah. Well, that way, yeah, just it's about an ounce.
So it is about an ounce, okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Something like that. I don't know, I never really measured it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks for coming back on the show.
Hey, are you recording?
I'm recording,
yeah.
Okay,
all right.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, a lot of times I'll start the recording early because I like to capture natural conversation.
Okay.
And then people sometimes won't know until 10 minutes in. They'll ask, so when do we start? And I'll say, I've been recording for 10 minutes.
Uh-huh.
And then of course, that takes them by surprise. So
I don't know. I don't know if I should have said that or not.
Well, I'm glad that we did a sequel to the first recording. You know, like when the first one came out, it was a popular one. And of course, people want to hear more stories.
More stories.
So,
yeah.
You know, after we recorded the first one, we sat down. Of course, just like in anything that you do, right? You remember everything afterwards. You always remember things afterwards when you go through an interview, when you take a test, and then when you do a podcast. So
that's true.
So for this episode, what we're going to do is hear all the stories that we missed the first time.
Well, you know, I only wish my dad was here to tell them. Because he had a hell of a lot of them. I'm just looking at this book that Nick, it was the, I brought it down here, the
Tiki Magazine.
The Tiki Magazine. This is the Volume 1, Second Edition. Mm-hmm. And there's a really great article in here.
So this is dated back to 2005. Summer of 2005.
Right? Yeah,
that
yeah.
was 12 years ago.
Yeah, and Jeff Berry did the article. And there's some really great pictures. If anybody can pick up any of these, man, you got to read the thing. Because actually, basically, it tells the story of just about everything we're going to talk about right now.
Okay, great.
Yeah, because anyway, it starts out where my dad, you know, came here from the Philippines. And the first job he got was in the Figaro Hotel.
Okay.
And
that's where he was a bellhop?
Bellhop, yeah. Okay. And he did that, I guess, about 6 months, and then promoted him to the elevator operator, and he used to always joke about, yep, moving on up.
Yeah.
Yeah, he had some pretty funny stories, but then after that, he went to the Beverly Hills Hotel, and that's where, poor Prohibition was just about ready to end.
Right.
And the manager said, you know, we need a bartender, so they sent him to bartending school, and he always jokes, it's in the article here, that Jeff wrote about when he went there, they were looking at him and saying, yeah, you know what, you're pretty young to be here in bartending school. He said, yeah, I am young, because he was just 21 then.
Yeah.
He was a young guy. Yeah. And usually it was older people that, you know, went to the bartending schools when they first started out. And anyway, he was bartending at the Beverly Hills Hotel for quite some time, and then Don Gunt opened up Don the Beachcomber, and he went over there and applied. And they hired him, and the rest is history, because he was one of the four guys. He was Don Gunt, and then two other bartenders, and then two other Filipinos that waited tables.
Do we know who the other bartenders were?
I don't know. I don't have that information. I wish I did.
I'm curious if they went on to continue to bartend or if it was a pass-through kind of job for them. Because I know that there were a few other Don the Beachcomber bartenders that had made names for themselves. One of them was Tony Ramos.
Tony Ramos, yeah.
And another one was Mariano Liquidini, I think is how you pronounce it.
Yeah.
He went from the Chicago Don the Beachcomber and was recruited out to start the bar program at the Maikai.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so he, and because of that, the Maikai is making drinks the way that he trained them to make those drinks. And it's all the way that he was doing them at Don's. So it's that original Don style, which is very much the same style that I see here at the TPT.
Yeah, well, you know, my dad only worked briefly at the Beachcombers, not quite a year, because another place down the street opened up across from the Chinese Theater, which was the Seven Seas.
Yeah.
And he applied there, and they offered him $10 more per week. Naturally went over there because $10 was a lot of money.
Right.
And that was like $40 extra a month. And I think I maybe mentioned this in the last broadcast, but my mom told me that they could pay the rent for their bungalow for the month, stock the refrigerator, and still have some money to go partying out.
Yeah, an extra $10.
Well, that was $40. And, you know, that was a lot of money in the 30s. You know, a loaf of bread was 5 cents, so...
Yeah.
Dan was making some pretty good money back then. Yeah.
By the time he went to the Seven Seas, did he already have people that kind of came into Don specifically for his drinks? I suppose I'm asking if he had quote-unquote fans that followed him over to the Seven Seas when he left.
Oh, yeah. All bartenders do, especially my dad, because he was... Well, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but when he was at the Lua in Beverly Hills, he was always... he carried... cigars in his pocket. I always asked him, well, why do you put those cigars in your pocket? And he said they were burying cigars. They don't make them anymore because they got the silver linings you put them in. I don't know why, because they're a pretty damn good cigar. But he says, yeah, what I, a good customer after dinner, you know, I'd say, hey, here's a cigar, you know, and right away, oh, Ray, thanks, man.
Yeah.
You know, so
he knew how to butter him up.
Well, of course, yeah. And that's why...
That's a good host.
Yeah, and that's why a lot of people always ask for him, you know, his station. Hey,
yeah.
Is it Ray here? You know, and, yeah. So then, you know, you talk and then you get a good tip and smoke a good cigar.
Yeah. Was the Seven Seas or was it the Luau where he used to see Howard Hughes?
No, that was the Luau.
It was the Luau.
Yeah. Yeah, speaking of that, you know, Howard Hughes, when he came into the Luau, that was like in between, like, the lunch period and in between before they opened up, so it was pretty quiet. Actually, I think maybe they probably closed then. And he used to come in through the back entrance, and he'd come in with two bodyguards, so my dad told me, and the chauffeur, and he'd park the car, and they'd come in through the kitchen. And one bodyguard would sit at a table, and another one would sit at the end of the bar. And he'd sit at the bar and drink and just whittle away on a piece of paper and drink and figuring out, I guess, all his business dealings and stuff.
And he looked like a homeless guy, right?
My dad said he looked pretty unshaven, long hair, really... well, that's when he was getting kind of goofy. Cause, his chauffeur used to... He told everybody in the kitchen staff, he'd open up the trunk, and that's when he wore one shirt, a white shirt, and black trousers. He wore it once, and then took them off and put them in the trunk because he had this fear about germs.
Right, he's a germaphobe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the chauffeur said, hey, if you guys want to take it, because he had his trunk full of clothes.
Yeah, trunk full of
now,
clothes.
Now, that's being rich.
Oh, yeah.
Can you imagine being that rich where you could buy one shirt and wear it once?
Yeah.
A nice shirt that costs a lot of money and throw it away?
I can't say that I could imagine that, but that would certainly be an experience.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what he was able to do. Another story, my dad was saying that when he was in there one night or one day, this one fellow came into the bar, and there was nobody in there, and he'd sit there and, you know, be writing his stuff and drinking. And this guy sat right next to him. And naturally, the bodyguards were like, hey, what's going on? And he was just, you know, just striking up a conversation, had a drink with him. And the ad said at the end of the conversation, this guy ended up buying him a drink before he left.
Because he thought he was...
Well, just a nice guy. He didn't know who he was. But he actually bought a drink for a millionaire.
For a millionaire.
Billionaire,
yeah,
or whatever. Billionaire, yeah. You know, so it's kind of funny because that time he could have bought the place and everybody in there.
Right.
Yeah, that's how rich he was.
Now, when Howard Hughes would go in there, was he going in there specifically to drink from Ray, or was it just a place he liked to hang out?
Well, he just hung out, yeah. Well, of course, he knew my dad.
Yeah.
But because that was
and he was probably friends also with Steve Crane, who owned
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, because it was a celebrity hangout.
Yeah, yeah. That's kind of funny, though. My dad told me that story about that guy buying him a drink. And
yeah.
It was like, wow.
That's pretty funny. That's pretty funny. I'm sure that your dad has heard all kinds and seen all kinds of funny stuff like that in all the years that he'd been bartending. Because, you know, like when you're at a bar, it's really like an unusual place sometimes, right? You get characters that walk in and out. Someone told me, it might have been Charlie, that George Lucas used to hang out in here in the Tiki T.
Yeah.
And no, it was the time that he was writing about Star Wars.
Well, what happened was, you know, he went to SC, and then when he graduated from SC, he got a job at some studio, I guess, in Hollywood. And he did come in here quite a bit, and I didn't know who he was, but with a bunch of other guys, and they hang out and drink drinks, but he always had a sketch pad.
Yeah.
And he was sketching, you know, all these stuff for Star Wars.
Right.
You know, and I look at it and I go, wow, that's pretty cool. I didn't know what they were. You know, yeah, it's different. You know,
right, yeah, yeah.
Lo and behold,
sure,
I didn't know
yeah.
that was, you know, the stuff for, you know, Star Wars. In fact, supposedly, now, you know, he donated a lot of money to SC, and they put up a building with his name on it. And they conduct classes in there. And somebody told me that when you go to the film class there, they do mention that supposedly, what's his name? Can't think of it. The little guy. In
Yoda.
There. Yoda. Yeah, Yoda is patterned after my dad.
I heard that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not the first time I've heard that. I know that the person who created the Yoda character drew it in his likeness, but the all-knowing... wise, seasoned person is patterned after Ray.
Yeah,
that's what I heard.
Yeah, George
and
Lucas.
I also heard, and I don't know if this is true or not, or if this is just something that somebody made up. I think I heard this from Charlie that the bar in Episode 4, Mos Eisley, that the characters in that bar were patterned after the patrons of the TKT, because George Lucas used to come in here. And he was writing that story when he was hanging out in here.
Yeah, well, yeah, he was writing a lot. I don't know, you know, what he was writing, but...
Yeah.
He was a nice guy, you know, everybody's having a good time, but he was always doodling, making those characters and, you know, comments about, well, he was probably writing out that bar scene.
Yeah, I could tell you, I could probably name a couple of the regulars in here in that bar scene. I could say I'm not going to name names,
yeah, okay,
but that's this person,
right.
And that's that person, and that's that person. So it wouldn't surprise me.
Yeah. Wow. I got a little story, too. My dad was, you know, he worked at the China Trader in Burbank.
Oh, yeah, the China Trader.
Yeah.
And, you know, I drove by there a few months ago with Boris, and he pointed out to me where it was. And I guess it was like a whole city block.
Well, it was right on the corner, and it's right across from Bob's Big Boy.
Right across the street from Bob's Big Boy, yeah.
But that brings up another story, because Bob Wyman, who, you know, was Bob Big Boy, mm-hmm. Well, he started off as a short order cook across from the Times newspaper in downtown L.A. And my dad and a bunch of other Filipino guys used to hang out down there after work, because they were open, you know, 24/7. And my dad, this other fellow, I don't remember his name, but they had a bet going on who could eat the most pancakes.
Oh.
And one of the other Filipinos, like...
I already feel sick.
End up, yeah. He ended up eating something like, I don't know, 20 or 22 pancakes.
Oh, my God.
And Bob Wyman always remembered that. And when my dad was at the China Trader, Bob Wyman came in, and he goes, hey, how's it going, everything? And haven't seen you in a long time. And anyway, he already had Bob's gone, Bob's big boy. So he gave my dad this card, Bob Wyman, big boys and everything, compliments.
Yeah.
So the original Bob big boy on Colorado Boulevard driving, I remember going in there with my mom, my dad, my sister, myself, and we would have a Bob big boy and everything,
yeah,
you know, in the car. And then my dad would whip out this, they'd get the check, they'd whip out this card, compliments of Bob Wyman.
Right.
And he'd give it to the car hop, and the car hop would go, I'll be right back. And she comes back. She's a manager. And the manager comes back and he goes, you know Mr. Wyman? And he says, yeah. And he says, oh, God, is everything okay? Can I get you anything else? You sure? What do you want? And,
My
dad said, no, that's fine. Everything was great. You know, and I remember we ate there, I don't know, maybe about two dozen times or something. And then later on I asked my dad, he said, what did you ever do with that card? And you know what he did with it?
No.
Threw it away.
Oh, no.
I go, what did you do that for? And he said, I didn't want to take advantage of it. You know, we used enough of
that's
it.
That's nice of
but
him.
The idea that you had his autograph on this card.
What I was going to say was it's a piece of history, right? I mean, it's a collectible.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, but yeah, of course, have his autograph on that card. I just think it's cool that not only did he know Bob, but that Bob said, hey, you can eat at my place free anytime you want. Here's a card.
Yeah, well, that was great. You know, it bummed me out. I go, what, you threw it? But that's not, I got it. There's another story where my dad actually probably threw away a fortune when he was working at Christian's Hut.
Okay.
On the Isthmus in Catalina.
So Christian's Hut was built for the taping of, what was the movie then?
Mutiny on the Bounty.
Mutiny on the Bounty. And Ray was brought out there specifically to mix drinks after, at the end of a filming day.
Well, yeah, Clark Gable, you know, after that was his name in the movie was Christian, Mr. Christian. And then he opened up that bar. And I guess it was a restaurant too and everything. And it was on the Isthmus on the other side of the island.
But it was just for the staff, right? For the staff cast?
No, because all the people that had yachts went over
there. Oh, okay, okay. So it was an actual...
Yeah, and...
I thought that opened to the public after the filming was over. I didn't know that was something that Clark Gable just opened up. Because I know that he opened that while he was there filming.
Right, yeah.
And I know that he requested Ray specifically.
Well, my dad worked there, I think, for two seasons, maybe three, I don't know. It was way before I was born. But
okay.
I know he was, I know for sure, two seasons he was there. Well, you know, that's where that story, he told me that story about with John Wayne and Victor McLaughlin and Ward Bond.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were one night at the bar there and they were drinking and somehow they got into some kind of an argument, dispute, and Victor McLaughlin got pretty mad, and he stood up and said, okay, let's go outside.
Right.
And we'll settle this outside. I'll take both you guys on.
Wow. Wow.
And my dad said, naturally, they both backed down because, you know, he was a real deal. He would have taken them out and knocked them both out.
Yeah.
Because they were tough guys on the screen, but he was a real, you know, he was a championship boxer, you know, and he would have knocked them out. No doubt about that. But my dad said, okay, you're right, Vic.
Yeah.
Naturally, you're better.
Yeah. And then Christian's Hut, I guess they started to open other locations. They had one over here in Newport Beach on Bebo Island.
Yeah.
And the Goof, which was on top of Christian's Hut, ended up on top of the Valley High.
Yeah.
Down in San Diego.
You know, another thing talking about Christian's Hut, when Victor McLaughlin, my dad told me the story where he was like, was very scared because Victor McLaughlin, he always, his favorite drink was White Horse Scotch.
Yeah.
And one night he was drinking that, and they ran out of it. And he ordered it again, and my dad switched him another scotch. And he just sipped it and right away called him over. He said, "Ray, what are you trying to do, poison me? This isn't White Horse." And my dad said, "Well, we ran out of it, Dick." And he said, "Well, get me another bottle." And he said, "How can you get another bottle?
You're on an island. It's out.
You're out." And my dad thought he was going to kill him again, but he survived, thank God. But I don't know what he drank, and my dad never mentioned it.
Don't cheat a man out of his scotch.
But see, that's all he drank.
Right.
Right away, he knew, hey, this isn't White Horse scotch.
Right.
So my dad probably gave him Ballantine's or whatever was available back in those days. You know, obviously, he must have drank it.
Of course.
You know, all the movie stars used to anchor their yachts and stuff, and that was the only place to go and, you know, have something to eat and drink because, you know, there's nothing going on there. And on the menu, all these movie stars, they signed it. And my dad had, he had over 100, maybe 200 movie stars' names.
Really?
Clark Gable, John Wayne.
In one of the menus there?
Yeah, it was on a menu.
He was collecting all their autographs.
He had it. And my dad, he used to always talk about it. And then he said, this one fellow was always, that used to, he was like a handyman there. And he used to, he always asked, like, "Hey, Ray, you want to sell that thing?" And my dad said, "No, not now." And it was kind of weird because years later, after my dad was on the mainland here, he met this guy in Hollywood and at a gas station, and they were putting in gas and everything, and he said, "Oh, yeah," whatever the guy's name was. And he said, "You still have that menu, Ray, you know?" And my dad said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, you want to sell it?" And my dad, I couldn't believe this, but he actually sold it to
him. No, he sold
it. Yeah. And I go, "You sold that menu?" And that was hundreds of names. This is autographed by actually the movie stars that hung out there.
Yeah.
And he said, "Yeah, I sold it for like 25 bucks or 30 or something," which was a lot of money back then.
Back then it was a lot of money.
Yeah. But I'm going, "I don't believe it. You sold that thing?" And I said, "Yeah." I go, "Oh, man, just that thing would have been worth a fortune."
Did he ever take photos with the celebrities that would come in and drink at his bars?
I don't. Back then, I don't think they had cameras that were, you know.
Yeah, I guess really, that probably wasn't a thing back then, right?
I mean, you had to have having a camera.
So it was an autograph book was the thing to do.
Autograph, As far as cameras, that was like you had to have some money to have a camera.
Did you ever hear about what happened to that menu? Did it end up in some kind of auction?
I have no idea. All I know is my dad talked about it. He says, "Yeah, I had this menu, and all these people that came in, you know, they would sign the menu, you know, and I had it, and Christian's Hut menu, and then this guy, I sold it to him." I go, "Oh, my God. You know what you did?"
Yeah.
But,
oh, well. What's done is done.
What's done is done.
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, it'd be kind of interesting. I wonder, you know, if it's still around or did it end up being destroyed or what? Because according to my dad, there was like over 100, maybe 200 different names on this thing.
Well, you know, we don't know what that guy did with it because there was really no collector market back then. So it might have been something that he cherished and then when he passed away, it disappeared with it, you know?
Could be. Yeah, who knows? I mean, there's all kinds of treasures, you know, they're looking at somebody's attic or garage or, you know, a barn or whatever.
Speaking of which, do you have any of the, like, original menus or anything like that from Don the Beachcomber when your dad was working there, or the Seven Seas or the Luau?
I've got some menus, but not a whole lot. A lot of menus, and we didn't take care of them, and they got, unfortunately, they were stuck in a shed where kind of termites got into it. And so it wasn't, I wish the heck they were, you know, who thinks about these things, you know?
Like I said, there wasn't really a collector market back then. I'm just curious if your dad just had saved anything out of prosperity or if it was just
a few things, but, you know, not a whole lot.
Right.
Yeah, but he did have quite a bit, but like I said, they got stuck in a place where the elements took care of it.
Yeah. Yeah, what a bummer.
Yeah. Yeah, but you don't know what treasures you have. And what's like nowadays, you know, people, real collectors, they know, "Hey, I'm going to be collecting this item, so I'm going to buy it, and I'm not going to even open it." Yeah. Just going to stick it away and.
Well, like some of that, when they do that with toys and things like that, and they just leave it in the package, you know, the difference between today and before was that everybody played with their toys because there was no collector market, right? So that's what makes it collectible now is that, well, if it has the original box, it's such a rarity. But nowadays, if you buy something off the shelf and you don't open it, that's actually kind of a common thing to do now. And people manufacture that stuff specifically for that purpose. You know, they'll even number the boxes. So, which is, you know, that's kind of a different kind of a collecting. It's not for me.
Yeah. Well.
You've got stuff in here that, you know, I'm sure people would consider collectible.
Oh, yeah. There's people where they see stuff and they go,
Not even the merchandise that you sell. I'm talking about just things that are in here that...
People have seen things and they go, Mike, I want to buy that. You know, I go, I can't sell that.
Yeah.
Why? It's just somebody donated it in here. Yeah, but, you know, that's really cool. You know, I'll give you $50 for it. I go, I can't sell it, man. Somebody gave it to us. And I'm not going to, if the guy comes back in and says, hey, where's my carving or whatever? You know,
I sold it.
And I'm like, that's not right.
Right.
You know, a lot of people have offered money to buy things in here. And I go, no, I'm not selling it because somebody donated it.
Yeah.
You know, if they come back in, they're going to go, well, where's that carving I gave you or that mug? You know, I don't see it.
Right. Yeah. Well.
Oh, I sold it. No. You what?
Can't let that happen. Yeah.
This episode is sponsored in part by Steadfast Pomade. Steadfast Pomade is a strong-holding, medium-bodied, water-based styling product for men and women, which leaves your hair looking slick, neat, and shiny with a clean, fresh scent. Its unique formula allows you to easily restyle your hair throughout the day and washes out with ease. Steadfast Pomade is American-made and veteran-owned. Available in original and anchor hold, get yours today at steadfastpomade.com. Tame the waves and keep it steadfast. This episode is sponsored in part by Tiki Diablo, artist, carver, builder, and mug maker, with an extensive client list including Mission Tiki Drive-In, Tonga Hut Palm Springs, Tiki Co., Hennessy's Tavern, Walt Disney Imagineering, Lowe's, and Home Depot, plus art installations at Latitude 29 and Undertow. For custom art, tikis, mugs, or build-outs, find him on Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter at Tiki Diablo, or on his website coming soon, tikidiablo.com.
He worked in a bunch of different bars. I know that one of the bars that he worked at, we were drawing a blank on the name at the last time that we recorded, which was the Palms of the Pacific in Anaheim.
The Palms in Anaheim, yeah.
And what I know about that bar is that they actually had live animals at the front of the building.
Well, you walk in and they had snakes and birds and, you know,
they had monkeys in there too.
They had monkeys, yeah. It was really cool. And before you walked into the place, it was like a long hall, not a hallway, but you know, thing you walked up to.
Kind of like a vestibule or something.
Yeah, and then you walked into the restaurant. That was really neat. You know, but then you got inside, that was a big place because it was a nice restaurant, and then the bar was kind of like oval, and it was four. Stations for four bartenders when it got busy.
And he was living out here in LA at the time, right?
Yeah, because I remember when he got ready to go there, he had to get up pretty early, and he'd always like iron his clothes and his shoes. They had to be all, you know, they wore white shoes in there. He was always polishing his shoes and stuff. And because there was the freeway wasn't open then, so he had to take the surface streets.
Right.
And that took a long time to get down there and back. Because, you know, the Santa Ana Freeway wasn't available then until, you know.
Yeah, so from L.A. to Orange County, side roads, and the roads probably weren't as big as they are today. He probably spent an hour, hour and a half one way getting over there.
Oh, easily, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that was... And my dad, I wish I could, you know, I always wanted him to write a book, and I was thinking, like, God, it would be great if he would have written a book on all his experiences and all the places he bartended, and you could title it Hollywood Behind the Bar.
Yeah.
Would have been a great title, but
yeah.
Never got around to writing it, but
Have you considered writing those stories into the book that you pictured your dad writing?
Maybe. I don't know. It's a lot of research I'd have to get into, but could be done.
I mean, we could record them all, and then we can type them out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's food for thought.
Yeah. I mean, we don't want those stories to die. You know, we want them to carry on.
Right? Yeah. You know, another place, too, that we got to talk about is the tikis.
The tikis. So the tikis was, for lack of a better term, a tiki-themed amusement park, would you say?
Yeah, well, Danny Baltz, he opened it up, and my dad met Danny. My dad was working at the a bowling alley in Whittier Bowling Alley.
Assuming he was bartending at the bar.
Happened was that they opened up, and it was a tropical bar. And Danny, at the time, he put in a waterfall in the back bar, and it went the length of the bar. It was like three times the size of the tiki.
Oh, this is in the bowling alley?
Yeah.
Okay.
And that's before Danny opened up the tiki. And he put in this waterfall. And Danny didn't know really what he was doing. So when he put it in, he put like five sump pumps in. And he didn't seal it correctly. And my dad said when they opened up, they put all the water in there and it just flooded the entire place up. And so they had to close for a couple of days. And they opened up, but for some reason, they never opened up with a waterfall going. And I used to go in there years back, and the waterfall was there, but they never had any water.
They're never running.
Why?
You were a kid probably at the time, right?
Well, I was 21 then.
Okay, you were 21.
I went in, all right. I could drink. But I'm like, why didn't they ever fix this thing? Because it was a beautiful waterfall, but they just left it, you know, and it wasn't running or anything.
Yeah.
Anyway, but that's how I met Danny, and they became good friends. And then Danny, he told my dad, he says, you know, I got 10 acres out in Rose Hills, and he says, I'm going to make this outdoor tropical place, and I'm going to call it the Tikis. And he did open it up, and that was great, man, because he had these caves that you walk through, and then he had like three huts, and each side of a hut, they were huge, about the size of the tiki. And in each hut, they had, you know, a bar, and then they had live music. One would have rock and roll, another would have jazz. And you could go in these huts and have these drinks, and then you walked out into this massive area where they had food and a huge bar, and then they had a stage where they had all the Hawaiian Tahitian shows and
right,
fire.
Right, such as a luau.
Yeah, and then in the back of it, they had this volcano that erupted.
Right.
This is all outdoors.
Yeah.
And it was amazing.
So did you used to go there a lot?
I went there with my dad.
But did you go there while he, like, was he working when you
Well, my
there?
Dad, my Danny, my dad opened this in 61. Danny opened that in 62. And he wanted my dad to go work for him, but my dad said, you know, I already have this going, but I'll help you out. So my dad helped him get, you know, contacts and where to get bar supplies and bartenders and all that stuff. And
did he ever bartend there at all? Did he ever?
No. Because he was busy, you know.
He just helped him get it set up.
Yeah. They were friends. I got to tell you, I don't know if I should say this or not, but it happened. I was there one day with my dad, and I guess I was around 15 or 16, and Danny, he was talking to my dad in the big area outside next to the stage, and he was talking about the bar and everything, and Danny swore like a trooper.
Yeah.
I mean, everything out of his mouth was F this, F that, and he swore all the time, and that's they're talking, and all of a sudden, his son comes up. Well, we didn't know it was his son. I hear this little voice say, "Hey, Dad, some fucking son of a bitch wants on you on the phone." Like, what? We look down, and here's this little kid about 5 or 6 years old, and he's swearing. But
that's awesome.
Well, Danny swore all the time.
Right. So it's just normal
and my
talk.
And we're like, "What? Did that come out
to
of this
that little
guy?
Kid?" Yeah.
Yeah. And then Danny said, "Oh," and he swore back and says, "I told you, I don't want to talk to anybody." Because he had a lot of creditors who were after him.
Oh, okay.
You know, and then he said, "Hey, I'll be right back. I got to talk to this guy."
Yeah.
So he left, and then he came back and continued the conversation with my dad. But it was kind of funny because I really remember that.
That's like, hilarious.
God, where did that come out of this little guy? I mean, like, but Danny swore all the time. You know, naturally, his kid's going to pick it up.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when the tikis moved to Lake Elsinore, did you ever get to see it at Lake Elsinore?
I never did. I wish I could have gone out there. Cause
it was supposedly going to be built bigger and better than the one when it was in Monterey Park.
Well, what I hear, that it was really, they had like water slides and the whole nine yards. And,
yeah.
And it was really, I don't know, he had some problems with the, that was out in, where was that at?
It was in Lake Elsinore.
Elsinore, yeah. He had some problems, I guess, with the officials there. And I think his wife was living on one section of the property.
Yeah,
it was huge.
Yeah. They got divorced.
Yeah.
And so she lived on one end and he lived on the other end. And I actually got to explore the apartment that he lived in because it's still standing, although it's vacant. And it's a dilapidated old building now. Hmm. But it's the last building still standing. What I would say the last original building still standing on that property.
Wow.
Yeah, you can go out there and there's chain link fence around it. And you'll see it. You'll recognize it. It's a two-story building that's got a bunch of the old tappa patterns still on the eaves. And you can see the rotted bamboo. And there, it still has the artificial cave formations out in front of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it doesn't have any doors or windows anymore. And it's a vacant building that's been basically weathered throughout the years.
Hmm. Wow. You know, when he had the tikis out in Monterey Park, there was a nursery right next door to it. And he's always telling my dad, you know, I got to get this property because if I want to get it, he wanted to put in like these Disneyland when you have the Jungle Cruise.
Right.
He wanted to put boats in and stuff. He said, that's what I want to do. Ray, I want to put in a nice little ride here. It'd be really cool. And he was always trying to get this nursery, but it wasn't to be because, you know, you got, what happened was I heard from some of the bartenders that worked there and the staff, like, you know, what happened, why they had it, got rid of it. Well, supposedly the story was that his wife, she, when you walked in, there was caves and everything. She built all that herself. And she was a hard worker.
That's
and
pretty interesting.
She was did a lot of stuff there with
wow.
him. But later on, he started fooling around with the Hawaiian Tunisian dancers.
Oh, yeah.
He started having a couple of affairs. And his wife said, hey, you know, you better knock it off. And
yeah.
I guess he didn't take heed. And she divorced him. And there went the tikis.
Yeah.
So that's what I heard from
him. Yeah, I think that it was a combination of other things as well. I mean,
yeah.
It was... Tastes were changing. Tiki was kind of falling to the wayside. And
well, you know, he had a great place there because when he opened up, he could accommodate like 3,000-5,000 people easy.
Yeah.
And he went to like the phone company, the gas company, and said, hey, I've got this place out in Rose Hills there, and it's, you want to have your company party, you can have a luau at my place. And you know, I can accommodate thousands of people.
Right.
Right off the bat,
right.
You got all these people,
you know,
which was great.
And when he was at his peak, I heard he was living pretty large. He was making a lot of money from that place.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Danny used to come in here, and I don't know, he was kind of obnoxious, you might say. But, you know, my dad and him got along real well. But.
Was the Tiki Tea a place that a lot of the people that were in the industry, like Danny Balls, for example... Was this the kind of place they liked to hang out because it was another tiki place? Or was it because they all knew each other?
Well, yeah. Well, my dad knew Danny from way back. And, you know, Danny wanted him to go work for him. And I said, no, I want to keep this place going, you know.
No, what about Tony Ramos? Because I heard stories about him that, you know, Jeff Berry was telling me once, and we were sitting here at the counter at the Tiki Tea, that Tony was bartending at a little place called Ciudad in downtown L.A., and he said to me, you know, they have no idea who they have. They've got him making the house margarita every day. He's making hundreds of them every day. They have no idea that this guy is this mixology legend. And that was the last I heard of where he was, you know, where we could actually get a drink from him while he was still working. Mm. And that was well over a decade ago. It was probably a dozen years or more ago when Jeff told me that. So... I seriously doubt that Tony Ramos is still working. You know, I don't even know if he's still alive, but...
Well, yeah, he'd probably be...
I'm assuming that he knew your dad, right?
Well, I'm sure the other, because all those guys knew each other
in
one way or another.
They both came from Don's.
Yeah, and they I remember because my dad, we used to go out to all these different places, and my dad always knew somebody, either the waiter or the bartender or bus boy or somebody who was working in all these places. You know, it's like, I wish I could remember half the places we went to, but, you know, as a kid, you know, all I knew is I could sit there and suck my Roy Rogers down.
Mikey was telling me about when this bar was first being built, and I believe it was you or your father who took him to go buy materials from the guys at Oceanic Arts. And he said, I was a little kid, and they took me over to their house because they still hadn't started their warehouse.
Yeah, no, I think I mentioned that before in the last one.
They were
Bob and Leroy started out of their house and in the garage. And I remember going through their house in the garage, and they had all this carvings, monkey pod tables, and tikis and lamps and stuff. It was really cool stuff. And then right after that, they had to... They got a warehouse because they had so much stuff, and when people were buying, they just couldn't do it out of their house.
So when Ray was bartending back in the day, and he was doing tropicals, I mean, that was his thing. Did he know that it was a thing, or is it just something that, like, I mean, you have a guy who says maybe a sushi chef, and you know, it's just a job to them. You know, I mean, even though they may be passionate about creating, you know, some kind of special dishes for their restaurants, you know, the places that they work. But for many, it's, you know, it's a job for them. Was Ray, like, aware that this whole tiki thing was a movement?
I don't know. I think it was just made basically a job, and you know, it turned in. It's like when we made the tiki here. You know, after in the 70s, he said, you know, I made a mistake. I should have, see, the bar is on, when you walk in, it's on the left side. And the reason why he put it on this side is because the sewer runs on this side. And he said, I should have put it on that side. Because if I would have put it
on the opposite side.
Yeah, because if I would have put it on the outside, we could have knocked out the wall easy and enlarged this place.
And expanded it.
Yeah. But he put it on this way because it was in line with the sewer from the house in the back there.
Right.
And he said, if I would have put it on this side, it would have been easier because we could have just knocked out the wall and everything.
Made the bar bigger.
It made it bigger.
Well, you know, it makes sense at the time why he would choose this side of the bar because of the sewer.
Right, yeah.
But at the same time, you know, there are photos out there of the bars that he's bartended at before. If you look at the original Don the Beachcomber and you look at Christian's Hut in Catalina Island, something that Boris and I noticed is that both those bars are laid out exactly the same as the Tiki Tea. I don't know if you noticed that.
Well, yeah, they're long and...
Well, they have the same...
With tables.
They
look...
I mean, if you look at the original Don the Beachcomber, it looks like the inside of the Tiki Tea.
Right, yeah.
So we think that it was set up that way because that's how he was used to running his bars, right? So I thought, oh, okay, so that's not a coincidence then that when you walk in that the bar's on the left. You know?
Well, I don't know. My dad said he was. I didn't think it would... Because that's when we started getting pretty busy in the 70s and everything. And then my dad said, you know, I didn't think it was going to be this busy. You know, I thought you just open up a bar and see what happens. And then sort of in the 70s, the disco thing came in.
Right.
And, you know, and we were busy during the disco years because, you know, people would come here to drink because you couldn't get a good drink in a disco. You go to the dance and party and, you know, maybe drink a beer or something. But
sure,
if you want to get a good drink, you've got to go to a bar. So a lot of people used to come here before they went to Hollywood to all these discos and stuff and to dance, and then come back afterwards and maybe have one on the way back.
Yeah.
So we weren't...
I mean, people still do that today, you know?
Well, yeah, of course.
That's a tradition here with the tiki, it seems.
Oh, yeah. You know, I got to mention this, that you know, my dad worked at there was a bar in... I remember going to this. It was on Ventura Boulevard in Studio City called the Ching Hao.
Okay.
And James Wong Ho, he was a photographer, a cinematographer for the movies, and he had a lot of, he was up for a lot of awards that he did. Anyway, he opened up this, my dad worked at this place too for probably about 6 to 8, maybe a year or so. I remember going to it, and we had dinner there, and it was a small place, but actually Jeff mentions this in the book, or in this article.
In the article.
Yeah, but back in those days, you know, my dad said that, you know, if you were Asian, you know, a lot of people were, you know, when we got married to my mom, it was a lot, you know, you don't marry a white woman, so yeah. They got refused a lot.
That was really controversial back
right.
then.
Yeah, well, when this guy, James Wong Lo, he opened up that the restaurant bar, my dad said, one night there was this guy, and he kept staring at him.
Yeah.
And he goes, why is this guy staring at me? And he kept staring and staring until finally James Wong Lo got angry, and he just said, hey, well, what are you looking at? And he goes, no, nothing. And then he got mad. And he started chasing them. He chased them around the table a couple of times and chased them out of the restaurant. Because he was staring at them. Like,
right.
You know, it's like... But my dad said, well, maybe he was staring at him because he knew that he was a famous cinematographer. Or maybe he was just staring at him because he was Chinese.
That's hilarious.
But he was the owner.
Yeah, I think you told me... a story once at the time, I guess, like, you know, this is after World War II, and there was a lot of racism towards Asian Americans because of that. And your dad had to take care of himself a couple times, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, in those days, all the Filipinos, they had to go out together, because if you didn't,
right.
if you went out by yourself, you know, because they didn't know, you see somebody that's Asian. You know, they're going to say, hey, there's a Jap.
Right.
You know, and you're going to get jumped and beat up. So if you went out with a bunch of other people, chances are you wouldn't get those problems.
Yeah.
You know, so back in those days, you had to watch your P's and Q's.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. What if times changed?
Yeah, times have changed. I remember, it's kind of funny because I used to get angry with my dad because he never spoke Tagalog. And he never taught it to my sister and myself. And... I said, well, why didn't you ever teach us? And he said, why? Why not? I mean, and then I finally realized that my dad wanted to become so Americanized that he ended up actually changing our last name, because our real name is Buhayan, B-U-H-I-O-N. And he changed
it from
Buhayan to Buen, which sounds more German. And he never spoke Tagalog when he was out. It was always English.
Right.
Always. But when somebody would come over to the house, he would speak it, you know, to his fellow, you know, people, but he would not speak any other. And because back in those days, if you didn't speak English, they would say, if you spoke another language in the 30s, they'd say, where are you from? Get the hell out of here. Go back to where you came from.
Oh, yeah.
They're very prejudiced. Nowadays, you go out and you go to a market or anywhere, there's 10 million languages being spoken, and it's no big deal.
Yeah. You know, when I was younger, it was the same thing. We migrated here when I was 3. And my parents wouldn't speak Tagalog to us because they wanted us to fit in at school. Because when I first came here, I was speaking, you know, half English, half Tagalog to my friends. And I didn't know that I was doing that. It was just me communicating. I didn't know it was a foreign language, that half my language was words they didn't understand. And so my parents consciously did not speak that to us in the house because they wanted us to get proficient and comfortable with our English so that we could fit in better and assimilate better. And so I'm like you. I also thought, well, why didn't you speak that to us growing up?
No, I wish you would have.
Yeah, you know, then because that way you'd have that language too, right?
Yeah, that's great.
Do you understand any of it?
Very little. Very
okay.
little, yeah. I mean, because you never spoke it. You know, I know some of
you
the
just
bad
know all the bad words, yes,
yeah,
and you're
yeah,
going to
well,
say that.
Of course.
Yeah, I understand it, but I can't speak it. I have a hard time sometimes. I can speak phrases, and I could probably speak broken Tagalog if I had to, but for the most part, I'm not fluent as a speaker, but I'm fluent as a listener, as long as it's not too fast, because if they speak too fast, man, it doesn't matter, even if it's English and they speak too fast, sometimes you do a double take, right?
Yeah.
So,
I remember one night, these guys were, my dad was talking to these Filipino guys, and they were speaking like all kinds of, I mean, I don't know what, they were real fast. And my dad was going like, yeah, and he's talking to them, but then after they left, I go, well, what were they saying? And my dad said, I don't know. I go, what do you mean you don't know? He was talking to them, and he says, yeah, but they were speaking Ilocano.
Oh, yeah.
And he says, that's another, there's so much, many whole dialects.
Yeah.
And he said, I knew a little bit. But he was like, yeah, da, da, da.
Well, because he's from Bohol. We just learned that earlier when you showed me his, I guess it's a form of like a passport, right?
Yeah, it's an identification, ID.
So what's the dialect in Bohol? Is that
Cebuano?
Cebuano,
yeah, maybe.
Might even
be
Visayan. Because my wife is from Bacolod, and she is, which is in that kind of same region, and she speaks Visayan.
Visayan.
When her family speaks, I can't understand anything that they're saying. But then they mix it with Tagalog, and then they mix it with English, and so it's just kind of a mishmash of, you know, of language.
All kinds of stuff.
And then that, I can kind of piece things together. You know, that and body language, and if they're laughing about something or they're scolding a child, you can kind of figure it out. If they're pointing at food, they point with their mouths, you know. So.
Just point.
This episode is also sponsored by Tiki Oasis, located at the Crown Plaza in San Diego, California, from August 10th through August 13th, and celebrating the island lifestyle. Tiki Oasis is the largest and longest-running tiki festival in the world. Enjoy four nights of DJs, bands, educational seminars, a classic car show, and a marketplace with over 100 vendors carrying everything from mugs, music, decor, clothing, and more. The theme for this year is international intrigue, so if you aspire to hopscotch the globe to execute an impossible mission or join a den of spies, then arrive in the appropriate attire and join us for a weekend of nonstop fun. For ticket information or hotel reservations, visit tikioasis.com.
Yeah, you know, also, you know, I guess I mentioned that my dad, he opened up the Dresden Room, you know,
Right, he was the first bartender there.
Yeah. Yeah, my dad... Well, actually, that was just when it was just the bar. They didn't have the dining area back then. It was just a bar. But
oh, really?
Yeah. Well, my dad told me that.
I didn't know that it was open just as a bar.
This is it was a regular.
And then they added the dining area.
Yeah, later Carl bought the next area and put in the restaurant.
And he created the Blood and Sand.
Yeah, my dad said that in back of the bar there was this giant mirror. And he said it was really nice. And he said one night. You know, they served a lot of beer, I guess, and one of the patrons got really drunk and mad, and he took his mug and he just threw it and broke the mirror. And everybody got mad and just jumped and beat the hell out of this guy.
Wow.
He said there was this beautiful long mirror in back of the bar, and this guy, for some reason, threw his glass and just broke it and shattered all over the place, and then they just beat the hell out of this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, you got to be careful with how you treat a bar, especially with regulars there. If you're messing around on in their beloved bar, you're doing some kind of disrespect to it.
Well, yeah, you don't want to disrespect it. Yeah, that's a place where you know you want to hang out, and that's your place.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Now, what about some of the people that come in here into the TKT in modern times? I know that we've talked about Nicolas Cage. What about some of the others that have showed up here? I know that there are some stories with, say, Drew Barrymore.
Yeah, well, she came in quite a bit. Now she's married and has a family, but when she was single, she used to come in and with her entourage. And she was nice, though. I liked Drew. She was, when I first saw her, I was like, damn, she's tiny. She's like, I think maybe 5 feet. Mm-hmm. You know, she's, you think like, in her movie, she looks like a lot taller. But she's a really tiny lady. But she's nice. She just liked to party and have a good time. I remember one time she was feeling no pain, and she goes, oh, Mike, yeah, I really love the TPT and blah, 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 all this stuff. And then all of a sudden she grabs my hand and she gives me a kiss on the hand. And then after she left, everybody goes, Mike, Drew Barrymore just kissed your hand. And I go, don't wash it, don't wash it. Right. You know, what are you talking about? You don't wash it. It's Drew Barrymore. Big
right,
deal,
right.
You know?
I know that Huell Hauser used to hang out in here a lot.
Yeah, Huell was a great guy. I miss him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was right next door here when this was Channel 28. And he used to come in here and have some drinks and then go next door to Chavo and then you'd go up to the dressing room, you know, and usually hit all these three places. And just before he passed away, you know, he called me over. He says, Mike, I want to talk to you. And I go, what's up, Huell? And he says, his criteria is he didn't do bars. And he says, I'm rethinking on my criteria on your place here because you're not just a bar. You have the rich history of your dad, you know, way back with all these drinks and everything and your family run. So you're a little bit more than a bar. So he was thinking about doing, you know,
right.
an interview here.
Right. I remember.
And I go, hey,
that's nice.
And then 3 months later, actually my wife told me, oh yeah, Huell Hauser died. And I go, what? And then I turned on the news, and sure enough, he passed away.
What was it like when he would come in here? Was he talking to a lot of the patrons? Were people starstruck with the guy? Did they bother him?
Well, they look at him, they go, hey, you're Huell Hauser. Yeah, okay.
Because he's got such a friendly demeanor on screen that, you know, he seems so approachable. So wherever he goes, I'm sure that people bombard him all the time.
Yeah, no, he was cool, though. You know, he talked to people and, you know, take pictures with him and stuff.
Do you remember what his favorite drink was?
he had a drink called a Dirty White Mother in Malibu.
Okay.
That consisted of, let me see, that was milk, Kahlua, Malibu rum, brandy. Milk, Kahlua, Malibu rum,
man,
brandy.
That sounds disgusting.
Actually, it's not a bad drink.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But that's... Well, he didn't drink it all the time, but he did drink that.
Because what threw me off there was the Malibu rum. So,
Dirty White Mother in Malibu.
Oh, man. You know what? I might have to try one of those now, just out of curiosity. Was that one of his own, or did he bring that in from somewhere else?
That's what he ordered. He says, hey, can you make me, what's in it? And he said, yes. You know,
so you guys, did you guess on the proportions of the ingredients? Or did you just make equal all the way through? Yeah.
It actually had a little banana too in it. So actually, it was a pretty good drink. Not bad. Sweet.
Okay.
Because it's got Malibu rum.
Was he the kind of guy that would always drink the same drink?
No, he'd drink other drinks, but you know, he'd drink that drink, you know, every once in a while.
So what was the moment like when you guys put him on the wall?
Well,
I'm sure he was excited about that.
Yeah.
Did he say that's amazing? Did he say wow?
Wow, you're going to put me on the wall? Do I deserve this? He put down the year and he said, and counting.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we had it up here, but we took it down and put it back.
Yeah, I got his old spot. Yeah.
So somebody would see it and probably take it off and, yeah, this is a souvenir.
Yeah.
So we just have it in the back of the cash register on the side.
Right.
Actually, we've had a lot of celebrities. A lot of people say, Mike, why don't you ever, all these people that used to come in here, why don't you ever get their autograph and pictures with them? I'm like, I don't want to bug them. They have to deal with a paparazzi enough. And, you know, you should be able to come in here and relax and have a good time. And, you know, if they want to take a picture or something, that's fine. But I'm not going to go, hey, can I get a picture with you or all this stuff. Jack Palance used to come in a lot in the 70s.
Oh, did he really?
Yeah, no, he was a cool guy. And one thing, when he spoke, everybody was listening because he had that voice.
Yeah.
You know, and he was raised on a farm, and he used to talk a lot about husbandry, about the seasons for planting and raising cattle sheep and all this stuff, because he knew all of this stuff.
And right.
He was a very interesting guy. Yeah. I didn't know, you know, I always thought that, his nose, he had that nose that looked like a boxer. I always thought that he was a boxer, but he got that nose because he was flying a small aircraft plane, and it lost power, and he crashed into a field, and he took a nosedive straight into the thing.
Wow.
And what he did is he hit the control panel,
and that's how
he broke his nose, and that's how he got to look like that.
Oh.
I always thought he was a boxer. He didn't get that from boxing.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. I wonder if he told everybody the truth, though, if he was like Trader Vic. Like Trader Vic, he was walking around with a cane because of, what did he have in his leg? It's something that happened in his leg. And then, but he told everybody that it was from a shark encounter or something, you know? So,
okay.
You know, because it's part of the legend or the character, right? So, he had to look like a modern day Indiana Jones.
Oh, yeah. Okay, what was that? Boholanos. Yeah.
Boholano. Okay.
Yeah, that was that. Yeah, you know, my dad, there was a. There was a club that I wonder if they're still together, the Boholanos of Southern California, and they met. My dad belonged to it, and they used to have luau's and the whole nine yards and stuff.
Ah, interesting.
I don't know if they're still around, because after my dad passed away, I never got into.
So, you know, something that's interesting to me. I don't know if it's going to be interesting to our listeners, but. Tell me about the house behind the tiki.
The house behind the tiki.
Wasn't that house built by your dad's family?
No, actually, there were two houses back there. Well, there was one house. And my grandfather and my grandmother lived in that house, which is no longer there. And my grandfather built this building, which is now the tiki. And my grandfather repaired musical instruments. He and his wife lived in that house, and he repaired and sold musical instruments, stringed instruments here, and then he moved down to Orange County. And my dad, we moved into that house. And then later on, my dad built the house with issues back there.
Yeah, so
now.
He did. He built the house behind the tiki.
Yeah, he built it as
it was a kid or something, right?
No. What he did is he did most of the work. And he used the contractor's license, so it wasn't that expensive. Because the contractor, all he did was he did the finishing work. My dad, I remember I helped him dig the foundation, everything, put in the cement for the foundation on the house, and that was a pain in the ass.
Hey, it's still standing.
It's still standing, yeah. And he did a lot of the stuff there himself.
The front entrance of the house, which is all gated off, is, I guess that was the front patio, or was
that patio he put on later on.
So it's got your name in there in the concrete with a football on it.
Yeah.
How old were you when you wrote your name in the concrete?
I was about 10.
10 years old. And then inside the house, what a lot of people don't know is that the family used to entertain in the back room there, which was all tiki'd out.
Yeah, no, there was another bar.
Yeah, there's a tiki bar in there.
Actually, my dad, that was a wet bar, too. He had plumbing in there, and we used to have parties. Wow, some really good parties back in those days.
Yeah.
You know, my dad would make adobo and ponset and all that stuff.
Right.
And then make some tropical drinks, and everybody would go back there and party out.
And I like to say I'm fortunate enough to have been able to see that room more than once. I know that that's now being used for storage mostly.
Yeah, well, no, we tore out a lot of that stuff. But
yeah. But yeah. It's still got the bones.
It's
still got the old tiki bones in there, and you still got the bamboo and all
bamboo,
that.
Bamboo, yeah.
That bar is still in there, too.
Well, so yeah, well, yeah, the front part of it, yeah.
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 That's pretty cool.
Yeah, you know what I wanted to mention, too, when getting back to the Seven Seas, and, you know, Bob Brooks, he was the guy that owned it, and my dad was saying that he was one of the strictest guys to work for.
Okay.
Every night, he said they had to take an inventory of all the bottles, because back in those days, they would take the bottle and he would mark it down each ounce. And you had to match your ounces with the cash register.
Right.
And he said, man, you can get out of there for hours sometimes.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
If they had to check every bottle.
Every bottle, yeah.
Wow.
And he said that, he said Bob Brooks was he was a fair guy because he would always stand up for employees. If an employee had something, a patron was saying something, he would take the employee first rather than the the patron.
Yeah.
So my dad said one time one of the guys didn't want to pay his bar tab. And he told Bob, and Bob said, well, which guy? And he pointed nice at the guy right there. So he said, what happened was, you know, when you walked in, there was a hat check room. Because you had to, you know, back in those days, you had to take your hat and pull it off and check it in before you, you know, everything was high class back in those days.
Right.
He said, Bob waited until this guy was ready to go. He said, he grabbed him and pulled him inside and knocked him out.
Wow.
And he said, Ray, how much does he owe? And my dad told him. So he went in and got the money out of his wallet and just what he owed. And then and he said, you know, call a cab and get this son of a bitch out of here.
Yeah.
And then
wow.
Well, that are was tough. Those days.
No, things were tough back then, yeah.
Yeah, because my dad said, Bob wouldn't mess around, man. He just said, the guy didn't want to pay his tab, so he just
he
got
man.
It out of him one way.
Yeah. Don't mess with the old school bar owner.
Yeah, the old school.
You ever have any issues like that here?
As far as somebody not paying their tab?
Yeah, or just having to deal with a customer that's like...
Through the years, we've had a lot of crazy incidents here.
Yeah.
But now things have kind of mellowed out through the years. We haven't had way back and... Yeah, there was a lot of crazy people that used to come in here and stuff. And I remember one night, there was one guy, we wouldn't let him in the door. And I wasn't at the door. There was another guy, Ray. This guy I went to high school with, and he was kind of helping out at the door. They wouldn't let him in because it was something. And he said, oh, you'll be sorry, you'll be sorry. So apparently he went down the street and he called the cops. And he said, oh, yeah, they're robbing the TPT. There's a robbery at the TPT. So next thing we know, there's all these cops are outside, and then they're with their shotguns, and they're telling
Holy
everybody, come here.
Yeah.
And everybody's like coming out the bar.
One by one.
Yeah, one by one. And then they find out that it's a false alarm. And then they say, well, we got a call that somebody was robbing the bar. And they say, well, yeah, it's got to be that guy. A couple hours ago, we didn't let this guy in. And he said, you're going to be sorry here. When he must have called the cops and said that.
Yeah.
And he said, that was a false alarm.
Wow. I wonder if they find that guy or... you couldn't get away with that today.
No, you couldn't, but you can imagine what that costs the taxpayers.
Oh, yeah.
No, one time, man, I felt sorry for these two guys. This is another story that goes back into the tiki. There was two policemen that were on call in Chinatown, and they went across an intersection, and they were broadsided by another car, and they were both killed. And there was these two policemen came in, and they had just come from their wake and everything with their wives, and they were dressed real nice and everything. They sat at the bar. You know, there was this one guy that was coming in here off and on for about a year or two. And that one night he came in, he was a little bit odd. I mean, he just wasn't himself, and he ordered a drink, and I made it for him, and he went to the washroom, and then the two ladies sat down at the bar, and he came out and reached over to got a drink, but then he said something derogatory to the two policemen's wives, I guess, or girlfriends. And the next thing I know, they start having words, the two policemen and this guy. And the next thing I know, this guy leaves, and he's gone. And this is at the time across the street was La Via Tosca, was a Mexican restaurant across the street. Well, apparently, this guy went across the street, and he met some guy over there, which was a Marine, a jarhead. And he comes in here, and he looks at the door, and these guys are still at the bar, and he points there. And the next thing, they come in, and they jump these guys, and they start fighting. It's like, what the hell's going on? So, turn the lights on, and finally, we get, so hey, and this is like on a Friday night, people are starting to come in, it's like, we got to call the police. And luckily there was a cop at the end of the corner giving somebody a ticket. So somebody went up there and told them that, hey, there's some police down at the tiki and they need assistance. So right away, the cops came.
Yeah.
So then they got these guys outside. And then they got them, they had them lying on the ground and they got shotguns in their face. And, you know, and they're sort of talking to them. And one cop says, okay, you know, you've had your say now, shut the F up.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, these guys, Lee, I feel sorry for these guys because their suits were kind of torn. They get in this big fight with these guys. You know, and this Marine, he didn't even know this guy. He just picked them out of nowhere. He said, let's go over there. And he started fighting with these guys. Anyway, they arrested him. And then a couple days later, I said, well, what happened with him? Did they press charges? And they didn't want to press charges, so they were in jail for a couple of days, and that was it.
Right.
But what the kicker with this story is, about a year later, this same guy comes back in, and he goes, he orders a drink from me that started all this stuff. And I looked at him, I go, wait a minute, you were here a couple of years ago and you started that big hassle in here,
right,
big fight with the cops. And he goes, yeah, Mike, but you know, I was one of those things where I just broke up with my girlfriend and I just had a bad day. I lost my job. And I said, look, I don't want to hear your crap, man. I'm sorry, I ain't serving you anymore.
Right.
And I thought he was going to give me some crap.
Yeah.
But he goes, well, you're not going to serve me? I go, no, you're going to have to find another place to do your drinking. So he got up and left.
Good for you, yeah, man. Wow.
But I remembered his face. I go, wait a minute, you're the guy that started all that crap.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. Well, it's looking like we're getting close to opening time, so let's wrap this up. Thanks again for sitting with us.
Yeah, no, it's
on
great.
The podcast. It was nice getting some of the old stories.
And by the way, you know, we want to be the contributor to the program.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, so we're going to donate some, maybe some mugs, and well, we'll figure that out.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, you heard it here first.
Whatever you guys want to have to put out.
Oh, great. You guys heard it here first. We're going to have Tiki T be our newest sponsor on the Desert Oasis Room podcast. And so we'll see what kind of goodies they poured over to us, and maybe we'll do another Wheel of Excitement for some prizes with some Tiki T memorabilia.
Yeah, sounds good.
Awesome. Every Wednesday we do the Toast to Ray at 9 p.m. So if you guys are in the area, stop by and get a Ray's Mistake for $6 until 9 p.m. when we do the toast. We'll do a toast to the founder, Ray Buen, this excellent bar here and somewhere between L.A. and Hollywood, right?
Yeah, somewhere.
Yeah.
Just remember, all roads lead to the Tiki T.
All roads lead to the Tiki T. 4427 Sunset Boulevard here in Los Angeles. And if you guys have any other questions, comments, or just want to leave a shout out for anybody, including a friend that's maybe having a birthday or for yourself, hit us up on our Facebook group page, Inside the Desert Oasis Room, or find us on Instagram at Polynesian Pop. Thanks again, Mike.
Okay.
For part two.
Hey.
Cheers and aloha.
Cheers.